Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 44 years now. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we get together in for our radios, and we exchange information. We learn from each other. We teach each other. Hopefully, we entertain each other. And so I'm hoping that we'll have an opportunity to do that again tonight. And thank you all for returning. I hope not too many people were tuckered out by field day and decided to go to sleep at 8 o'clock. So we'll see how things go. Anyway, let me drop for a second, and I will return with the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, you can do that. That would be either for mailbag questions. Those would be questions if you couldn't reach the repeater that you wanted to ask, and we'd answer it on the show, on that, and you could either listen to the audio stream on the Internet or the archived file of the net, or you have a TechNet tool. We're always looking for them. They're as rare as hen's teeth. Or if some technology has made the news and you understand it better than most of us and you'd like to explain it to us, that's great. Give me an email and ask and you shall get. Or if you would like Paul to comment on some space-related story, You can directly contact him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if you'd like to email me, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, as the week progresses, I cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles and YouTubes and all kinds of stuff that I found interesting that I'd like to share with people, and I put it on my link page. You can get to the link page by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. And it's open 24/7, so any old time you want to peruse it, feel free. We have a chat room open. It's not really been used much in the last month or two, but you never know what might happen. If you want to access it, you type into the browser chat.a2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. As I mentioned earlier, we offer a Internet stream of the audio of Technical Net. Leave it on the rest of the week so you can listen to the Glen Oaks repeater output through that of an Internet service provider. You get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It has the archives of the Limark Technical go as far back as September 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of hams that have moved out of the area or have become, unfortunately, silent keys through the years. So with that all in mind, let me drop for another second, and I'll tell you what we got planned. We got a standard operating schedule for tonight. Again, I hope not everyone took a nap because of field day. But hopefully some people will like to relay their field day experiences this weekend. We'll ask for the usual questions, comments, topics for discussion, preferably amateur radio related first, but we're open to discuss any aspect of science and technology as it progresses. That should take us hopefully to about 10:15. Paul WS2N will bring us the SpaceNet report until approximately 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on it and wish you all a good week. That's the plan if everything works. Last Sunday, the All-Star node got a little bit cracked, and it was only feeding to Selden. It wasn't feeding to Glen Oaks, and so I talked to people in Selden at the very, very end and wished them a good week, but people in Glen Oaks didn't hear anything because All-Star wasn't connected there. We'll see how things work tonight. You know, we're always subject to the whims of the laws of physics. So with all that in mind, let TechNet begin. If anyone has any questions, comments, topics for discussion, hit that push to talk and give me your name and your call sign. Well, gee, maybe everyone did take an early nap. Let me relay what my experience was this morning. I was in my other club, the Kings County Radio Club's 10-meter net, so I was operating in D mode in my shack, and we got a couple of transmissions from Kings County Radio Club's field day. We had some traffic from them. We had some traffic in the metropolitan area, and fortunately, although it didn't seem to be terribly good communication, we seemed to have a connection with Arizona, and we talked to two Arizona stations this morning. So 10 meters was decent, not as good as I would have hoped it to be for something like field day. I would have expected a lot more activity, but nevertheless, it was open to at least Arizona. Anyway, that was my two cents. Hopefully it gave some people time to wake up from their nap and turn their radios on and mop their vacuum tubes. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussion or comments to make tonight, please hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your call sign.
K2SCP Mobile, I have a really quick question for you, Roy.
Sure. I prefer in this atmosphere a very, very long question, but I'll take a short question.
Understood. Back, way back when Dick, K2RIW, was doing the tech net, he used to often refer to a chinnet. A ham had given, he used to teach classes about waves, magnetic waves, electromagnetic waves, and antennas. And he had, he would be in front of a classroom with a bunch of pipes that were powered and had a transmitter attached to them, and he'd move the pipes around and do different things to demonstrate what occurred when they were longer and shorter and shorted and whatnot. And for the life of me, I can't find, I used to watch that, I watched it a long time ago, I cannot find that. I'm wondering if anyone out there remembers it. That was what I'm talking about. K2SCP, that's right.
DDH with a comment?
Yeah, John.
I think that might be the Dr. Shive wave machine, which is on the ATT tech channel. I think that's what you might be referring to. They were torsion waves that were sent down a length of pipe and that had cross arms on it. I think that's the reference.
That definitely sounds like it. Yeah, he used to, there were several pipes, I think. You know, they were copper pipes, and they did have some cross members, and he would adjust those cross members, and as he adjusted, he was watching the results, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it was viewed edge-on, and he would send a wave, a displacement, a torsion wave, down these length of pipes, and viewed edge-on, you would see this pulse, or like this wave, propagate down, and depending how it was terminated, you could see a reflection. That video is still available on ATT Tech Channel. American Telegraph tech channel. It's called Similarities of Wave Behavior by Dr. Shive, S-H-I-V-E.
Perfect. That's exactly what I needed. Thank you very much. K2SCP. And sorry, Roy, it's not not very extended, but maybe you can elaborate on it. Have you ever seen this thing, Roy?
Yeah, I did. As you mentioned, Dick used to. He didn't quite mention it as much as Brown and Woodward curves, which was probably every Sunday. But yeah, he mentioned it a few times. It's a nice a demonstration of underlying principles of wave-like procedures. So it's one of those old Tommy videos as well. So you can sort of tell that it's probably produced, you know, sometime like the 1960s. But it was a very, very well produced demonstration. And, probably during the Space Network, I'll look it up and put it on my Roy's list so that people will just be able to click on it and take a look at it later tonight.
Yeah, that would be awesome, Roy, because it was very educational from what I recall, but it was quite a few years ago, probably 20 years ago when I remember watching it. I've had that in my mind for a while, and as you know, I've been kicking around different things that I had out and just trying to learn something about this. Magnetic electromagnetic waves, it's so complicated. I have a difficult time with it. It's crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of math and mass involved in the real case, and it gets even worse. You know, like I've often kind of said, a lot of science is like an onion with almost infinite number of layers. So, you know, there's Newtonian electrodynamics, but there's also quantum mechanical electrodynamics, which if a matrix math and old-timey Maxwell's equations give you a headache, the quantum mechanical iterations of the concept will split your head in half. But it's a very good film. Again, it was obviously made by AT&T in the 60s or the 50s, so it has a little bit of that flavor of a video I posted about a month ago on how in World War II they manufactured quartz oscillation crystals. It's kind of an old-timesy approach that you don't see much today in videos, although I'm sure there's a plug-in mimics that type of effect. So, like I said, unless I completely forget, when Paul is doing the SNET report, I'll look it up and post it on Roy's link, which is, roy.ac2gs.com. So thanks for the participation, Chris. I hope it's the first of many tonight as opposed to the last of one tonight, but we'll see. Anyway, once again, I continue to be C2GS. I continue to be Roy. This continues to be the Limark Technical Map. We're open for business, and I hope we have people with questions or comments. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, the Limark site is very good. Very, very nice. I spent a little time over there, not too long. But, they had a half a dozen tents, so that's, 6 alpha. And, the site is just great. You know, plenty of parking, gigantic pond. So it's a regular park, in Nassau County, Siemens Neck Park. So what I liked, it was easy to get to. If you're coming from the north like me, I'd take the LIE, which is a big road, of course, and then you take the 135 directly south, and that's a big road, just like an expressway. You go all the way to the end of the, fall off the end of the road, and go a couple of few blocks here, a few blocks there, and you're there. So that's very nice. And, of course, the heat was a problem, but being on the South Shore, I think it was a couple of degrees cooler than, let's say, you would get if you were, in the middle of the island. But up here,
okay, very good. My other club had their field day over at Floyd Bennett Field. They've been doing Floyd Bennett Field for decades. We thought we weren't going to be able to go there because the immigrants have an area where they're being held, and we found out that we could get an alternate area within Floyd Bennett Field, and about a week right before field day, we were advised that we could have our old area to use, so it was the old area. It's an old familiar place. It has some problems with flooding if there are a flash rainstorms. The whole thing kind of gets flooded, unfortunately. And they had little problems with some lightning last night. But otherwise, they were able to parade. Another success story. Everyone had a good time. And I hope other people out there listening in had a good time the old day. If anyone wants to share their experiences and what kind of contacts they made, please feel free. you know, it's a strange thing. We have people listening, I'm sure, because I'm looking at the audio stream that I'm putting out. And let's see, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, I got seven people listening to the audio stream. So it might be an interesting case where there's more people listening to audio stream than listening to the radio. Don't know. But as I've repeatedly mentioned to you guys, this is a dialogue. This ain't no monologue, or it's not supposed to be a monologue. So it takes two. So if anyone out there has any topics that they would like to chat about or get with or ask questions or comments about, then please, hit that push to...
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Yes, what can I do you for today?
So I see some, most VHF radios are go up to 50 watts, that would be mobile. Some go up to 100. Is there not a difference between 50 and 100 watts because it's only like line of sight to the horizon anyway? Is that why all the mobile radios are 50 watts, not 100? Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Well, I think there's a combination of things. Most times when you're talking about a mobile 50-watt transmitter, you're dealing with UHF-VHF, in which, yeah, you have more of a case of line of sight is the issue, not necessarily a power output. The 100-watt radios are usually base station radios. They're usually HF. They might include UHF and VHF, but they're primarily HF, in which, you know, the more power, the better. When you really think in terms of S units, S unit is
6
decibels. Say again?
6 dB.
Yeah, 6 dB, which means that you have to quadruple your power. You have to go from 50 to 200 watts to have a 1S unit increment. So it wouldn't really, wouldn't really change that S meter much. But, I mean, sometimes all you need is a little bit extra power. If you're barely intelligible and you raise your power 50 watts, you might go from barely to much intelligible. So it's more of a line of sight, and the nature of mobile radios draw less power. They don't want to drain your car power supply, so they usually run 50 watts. But, you know, it's a factor type of reasoning. You know, going from 50 watts to 100 watts often does not really make a significant difference. I tell the story that when I first got into the hobby, I was able to receive Limewire, my transmissions were noisy as anything. They could barely hear me. And I couldn't get a decent antenna, so I decided to try and cheat Mother Nature, and I got myself a Mirage linear amplifier. So I boosted my 5-watt handy talkie signal to about 70 watts. And unfortunately, the moral of the story was that I was still incredibly noisy. I had to finally figure out how to get an antenna above my roof line, and it improved the output power humongously. So although occasionally power is helpful, it's not the ultimate solution. High efficiency, well-designed, well-located antennas are much, much more important than the amount of power you put into them.
Yeah, it makes sense. I was looking at getting something like the ICOM 9700 so I could look at the VHF, UHF on a waterfall. But I was trying to think, I could probably cheaper with just an AR dongle. ADT to you.
Do a CV.
Yeah, I agree. It's a lot. I mean, they're using probably ST as well, but you can get a dongle. If all you want to do is look at the waterfall, the spectrum, you can do it with an inexpensive dongle.
A2SCP.
Yeah, Chris?
Yeah, I just wanted to agree with you. Said that the power really, I find, doesn't make a lot of difference in VHF. There might be the oddball time where a little bit of power might help, like you said, but is really line of sight. I mean, marine VHS are 25 watts, and we go 20 to 30 miles, but you'll learn it's line of sight. There's nothing in the way. I'm, like right now, I'm on 3 watts on a handheld, but my antenna very high up on my roof, and hit Felton, which is 20-plus miles from my house. So that gives you an idea. I can go down to my base downstairs, put 100 watts, and you won't see a difference than the microphone. So I would say if you're looking at... Oh, you said you were looking at the 9700, which I do have, and I love the radio. It's absolutely overkill. I mean, I have probably used 10% of the features on the thing, but it's an absolutely fantastic radio, just like the 7300 for HF. What I would suggest looking for a radio with the features that you're looking for and the ergonomics that you're looking for rather than the power, because it really doesn't matter. A2SDP.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, as we've been talking back and forth, it's not that important. Feature set, price point, and what have you. A lot of radio operators like very inexpensive radios. So, you know, the 9700 is a beautiful UHF, VHF radio. And if you're interested in things like satellites and, if you're one of those few people who actually is considering buying the microwave attachment that they kind of showed as a prototype on one of the Japanese inventions, and because there was so much interest, they actually manufactured it. I don't know how many they sold. But it's kind of the high end of UHF, VHF. So if you like shiny, pretty things, then yeah, that's certainly it. But you could probably accomplish just about everything that you need to do with a much expensive radio.
How much, like, single-flight activity is on VH, UHF? What info would that give you can get there with FM anyway? Over.
Well, it's a different kind of route. There are some people who love it, very few. But most people don't use it. You're not going to get overworked doing single sideband. Back in the good old days, Dick used to mention that had a scheduled conversation guy every night, in which he would go, he would do it single sideband, long distance, and he would, I think, bounce it off of a water tower, if I remember incorrectly. So, you have some guy or a couple of guys that are really into long distance single sideband, that's the time that you bring out the linear amplifiers and the directional Yagis and such. But you're going to find a lot less traffic, I'm sorry to say. I've never set that up myself. I've talked to other people who were interested in it and dabbled in it. But it doesn't strike me as something like, FT8, where the band is always busy.
Can you talk to satellites with a vertical VHF, UHF antenna on the roof, or do you have to have a directional antenna, AD2DU?
Okay, that's an interesting question. The satellite antennas that I have seen promoted as satellite antennas were Yagis. And the idea is you got to kind of point it. I guess if it's right overhead, you may get away without doing it. I think most of the people interested in satellite communications do it with the Yagis.
Makes sense. Thank you for the information. To the U.
Okay, thanks, Alex, as always, for participating. I do appreciate it. Once again, still AC2GS here, and it's barely the beginning of the LiveWire Technical Net tonight. So we're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, or they want to regale us with stories of their accomplishments during this weekend's field day, just hit that push to talk.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I seem to remember the water tower story with Dick. I think that's when he was talking about 10 gigahertz on the X-band. He had a regular QSO with somebody. I believe it was the water tower. They were bouncing off the signal, and he was talking to somebody. I think he was in South Jersey or something on
milliwatts of power. I think that's what it was. The tumor, or motor brake that he had that in the car, and for a while he was working up in upstate New York, and he would to somebody on a regular basis going way up there through the mountains and everything. You know, he would lose them now and then, but then he'd get them back. And I don't remember where that station was, but he would communicate with them like all the way up to the middle of upstate. And, you know, you can go a lot further with that. And if you're operating as a base, you don't have a vertical antenna. You usually use horizontal antenna for that. But you can go, you know, hundreds of miles where you really can't do that with FM on 2 meters too well, that's for sure. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, he did a lot of work on UHF. I mean, he designed a linear amplifier for UHF, and I think he had it published in QSB. So I got a British book on the subject of solid-state linear amplifiers, and the K2RIW UHF linear amplifier was portrayed there in two pages.
Yeah. That rings a bell, but not. I've more or less forgotten about it. He used to talk about an amplifier that was built by some guy in Mexico, and he used to talk to the guy. And that thing was written up in QST. That was some kind of an elaborate amplifier, you know, and it was all discrete components, you know. I mean, a million components. I remember that, but now I can't remember the bands that thing was good for. You know, all these stories are starting to conflate my head back.
Yeah, it's like brain is a mixer, and it's basically mixing a bunch of signals and producing harmonics all over the place. What can you do? It's no fun getting older. But, it was, it had something to do with a strain amplifier. His UHF amplifier used a strip line as part of the components of it. Like I said, it made it to a publication in the United Kingdom. I was kind of interested when I came upon it when I was thumbing through my new book there on the subject. I didn't expect to find the K2RIW UHF linear amplifier, but there it was. So, yeah, I mean, he worked a lot of microwave. He worked a lot of UHF at the very kind of beginning of it back in the 50s. And, of course, everyone who's seen his QSL card with the array of Yagis that I think he used for bounce, that was a sight to behold.
Where he had the picture of him in the middle of this group of 15 Yagis, you know, and he's up in the middle of it. Unfortunately, I don't have that QSL card, but I did see that. I guess it was printed somewhere. It might have been in QST, like you said. Back to you.
Those were the days. Well, he did a lot of interesting things. I still remember him telling the story of how upset NASA was with him because they weren't expecting civilians to tap in to the Apollo transmissions. They felt that they had been violated. So that was another great story that Dick used to tell.
Yeah, right. That's true. And he even remembered the name of the guy. I think it was Deke Slayton. He's gone now. And Deke Slayton was the head of the astronaut corps. He got in some kind of a private conversation with him. But, they couldn't stop him. You can't stop him from receiving the signals. Got the signals from Apollo 16. That part I remember. Anyway, back, Roy. I'll be listening.
Okay. Yeah, all a great story. One of these days we should kind of bind them together. I every so often when Chris was talking about that AT&T video, I was reminded that Eric used a nag dip very frequently. Dick would give these impromptu discussions of how electromagnetic waves resonate back and forth and kind of peel off as they're bouncing back and forth, expanding waves, and go into it a lot more. And Eric kept on nagging him to sit down in front of a video camera so that he could record at least one kind of educational session so it could be kind of saved for posterity. And good old Dick was a very humble guy. Wasn't interested in it, unfortunately. It would have been a great thing to have still available. You can kind of pick apart the archive site of his explanation and discussion of standing waves and such. But I don't know. It would have been really nice if Eric was able to successfully nag him into doing that present thing.
Somebody else might have made the comment that he doesn't need a video. He's got, you know, countless hours of tape recorded by Mike. I should have this memorized. Anyway, the last two letters are NJ, but you know what I mean. He's got, you know, on amateur. Amateur TV, .tv. You can go to any of those, they call them reels, and look up all these different Sunday night nets, which would be a good thing. You know, if you've never heard, you bring that up and you listen to this guy, and he was just terrific. Very clear, and remembered everything. You know, you can go back 5 years before that, and they'll tell you the same story word for word back to you.
Yeah, that was my KC2NAI with AmateurRadio.tv. I mention it at the top of every single technical net. The problem with that, though, is that I think that maybe the first year he actually indexed it, you know, he would listen in and you know, give a couple of topics that were discussed. But after a short period of time, I guess he was busy with other things. So, you know, past the first year or so, nothing is indexed. So you just have to randomly search for these things. So, although, as you mentioned, a lot of these things became canned speeches. So, you know, if you missed it the first time, you'd pick it a second or the third. You know, he used to kind of say that he said this all before, but maybe the second time you hear it, pick up more of it, and the third time you'll pick up even more. So, although they're available, they're not readily available. You'd have to kind of hunt and peck over many hours, because it goes back to September of 2006. And for the last, 12 years, because if Mike ever missed one of those recordings, I gave it to him, because it was one time I remember way back at the beginning of me listening to the net where Mike lost the feed, and Dick was kind of not happy for that entire technical net the following week. So I made a point of recording the technical net and offering my services should Mike ever kind of drop one of the recordings, because, you know, everything electronic kind of fails. I mean, when I'm recording this, and I'm recording it now, I'm recording it, I think, on three or four different things simultaneously. So pretty much my house has to blow up in order for me to lose a recording.
QSDP.
Yes, Chris.
Roy, I posted a link to website, K2RAW. The website is still up. It's limarktechnet.com. So it's limarktechnet.com. And it has that picture Paul was referring to of him standing in the middle of a gigantic Yagi antenna. Maybe you want to post that on your site. I look at that from time to time. I have that while you guys are talking, and I click on it.
Okay, that'd be good. Yeah, that's from Mike, too. Dick used to call, KC2NJI Mike 1, And this guy was Mike too. He's located in Connecticut. He had kind of a he got the domain LimarkTechnet.com, and he posted it many years ago. And I think when Dick passed away, he just kind of he keeps it up, but he froze it, so it's like it was 4 or 5 years ago.
I put that link to your chat, man.
Yeah, I see it. I'll when Paul's doing his SpaceNet report, I'll try and get both of those on my page.
K2GJE
website. If you click on the space link, there's something about the early Dragon spacecraft that I had posted up there. He posted for me. Like, yeah, that's right. I've lost that URL. I'm copy that from what Chris just said. It's on the chat room. Very good. Thanks, Chris. Back to you.
Okay. Ed, you wanted to say something?
Yes, a small question. What line mechanically over?
Please say again. You broke up in the middle of that.
What is strip line mechanically over?
What is strip line mechanically over? Isn't that a transmission line?
I don't know. Is it like a piece of coax with a capacitor at the end?
I don't think it was coax. I think it was a PC kind of created strip line. You know, it had kind of two linear wire. It had traces going parallel.
In other words, this was printed on a piece of material, copper, and then they etched away the material they didn't need over.
Yeah, it was a PC board. It was mounted on a PC board, the components, and it etched a line with inside the PC board material.
It used tubes, or was it solid state?
It was tubes.
Okay, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
there it is. Yeah, I'm not sure about not being able to live on pure oxygen. They say they have pure oxygen when you're in a spacesuit doing a spacewalk. Said it's 3.4 pounds per square inch in a spacesuit. So I'm not sure about having to have it mixed with something else. That I've never heard of. But as far as the fly goes, that was 1967, January 27th. And with that white, he tried to open up the door from the inside, couldn't do it. Gus Grissom was going to be the commander, and Chatty was the. He never went up. You have two experienced guys and one guy that was going to be a newbie. And they would fill the spacecraft with pure oxygen, for a test, because they needed to, they don't want to overpressurize on the inside. They want to keep it under pressure. There were reasons for that. It had to do with actually trying. Well, one of the reasons to keep the pressure somewhat equal to 14.7 on the outside of the spacecraft. To do that, they needed to jack up the pressure higher than normal. Normally, there would be around 5% oxygen, pure oxygen, if they were in space, but because they were on the launch pad and they were doing a test, they didn't want to have over pressure on the outside of the spacecraft and low pressure on the inside, so they were bringing up the pressure of pure oxygen almost to the same pressure that you would have on the outside of the spacecraft. Now, with extreme oxygen pressure, certain things could ignite, if there was a spark. And if
fact, the aluminum, even the aluminum went on fire that was inside the spacecraft. Under pure oxygen or high pressure, you could actually burn aluminum. So they learned a lot of lessons from that fire. After that, by the way, the other Apollo missions that went up were a mixture of, you know, nitrogen and oxygen. They did do that. That's one of the things that they changed. This way, when you know, eventually they got to the spill, and those things were running. I think they were 10.4 pounds of, regular air, oxygen, nitrogen. And, if you did a spacewalk in Apollo in the early days, before they actually had a real launch, they would have been in space, and you need to switch to pure oxygen. They didn't have an airlock system, so that was the deal with that. So future missions, after that fire, they said if we have to do an EVA, and they did. What they did, they said the other two astronauts would be rise in a suit, to match the guy that was actually going to do a spacewalk. So everything had to be changed around, all because of that fire. They would have liked to have had it where, you go to space and just leave, 5 pounds pure oxygen in the spacecraft, like they do with Gemini and with Mercury. But of course, that all changed after 1967, after you lost Chaffee and White and Grissom. I guess back to you, WS2N.
Let me put in my two. You can breathe 100% oxygen. It's not a great idea. Oxygen is very destructive. It's very corrosive. If you do it long enough, you can produce pulmonary lesions. Neonatal babies. Originally, we were given 100% oxygen in those little transparent cabinets that they were held, and it started to burn out their lungs, and they learned from that problem. You two pilots used to breathe 100% oxygen for an hour before they took off. So it is possible to do, but oxygen is very dangerous and corrosive. Back when photosynthesis first evolved, the oxygen that was released from photosynthetic cells poisoned trillions and trillions of lives. They were simple lives back then, so no one's particularly mourning now. But it decimated entire millions of species because oxygen to anaerobic organisms is poisonous. So, but you can breathe oxygen 100% for short periods of time.
How about 8 hours? They go on 8-hour spacewalks. In fact, we have a couple of spacewalks coming up. They're breathing pure oxygen.
Well, going into space has never been a safe thing. There's a lot of different ways that you can get damaged. So probably that much pure oxygen is going to leave them with some degree of pulmonary problems down the road. But again, they're losing calcium. They're collecting intercerebral fluid that's distorting their vision. There's a lot of things that indicate that we were not particularly evolved for zero or near zero G environments.
Maybe it has to do with the pressure. The EVAs that they do today are 3.4 pounds, not 14.7 pounds. Oxygen at 14.7 is dangerous and not 3.4.
Well, yeah, the lower the pressure, the better. But generally speaking, pure oxygen is not the way we're designed to operate. We're kind of designed for the nitrogen-oxygen, not particularly argon mix that we evolved in. So, I don't know. Like I said before, I'm kind of amazed. Well, most of the early astronauts, although they had it tougher in some ways, at least it was shorter duration. It'll be interesting. Follow all these people who spent months, if not years, in the ISS and see if it kind of screws up their statistical health projections.
Yeah, okay. The 3.4 is what they use. And the reason they do it, if you were to run oxygen and nitrogen in your spacesuit, oh, wait a minute, I might time this out, stand by. Okay, if you were to run, you know, what they breathe in the space station itself, which is 14.7 pounds of pressure, and they are breathing nitrogen and oxygen, they have these massive nitrogen tanks attached to Questlab, you would have, you know, you would have to have higher pressure inside the spacesuit. You won't even be able to open and close your gloves. You know, it's like a basketball. You know, basketball, I think, is 11 pounds per square inch. You know, if you had your hand inside of it, you tried to bend something, it's not going to work. But if you get that pressure down low to 3.4, you can. The deal is, if you're up at a high pressure with nitrogen, you need higher pressure to get the proper amount of oxygen in your system. If you're doing an EVA, you know, to get the equivalent of that same oxygen, you lower the pressure as low as you can. And it used to be around 4.5. Now they've gotten it down to 3.4. Then what happens is you're getting the proper amount of oxygen into your body. But of course, to get there, you know, you have to do away with the nitrogen or any other gases. But that's how they come up with this. Otherwise, every spacesuit would, you know, have the same pressure, and you know, you wouldn't have to go through this elaborate system every time you go outside the space station. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's a matter of partial pressures. You need at least the 21% atmosphere oxygen. That is the partial pressure of oxygen in our atmosphere. And if you have a rigid spacesuit, it shouldn't have much of a problem, but they're trying to go flexible up for obvious reasons, and because you've got the vacuum of space on one side and the pressure on the inside, you want to minimize the differential to make life a little bit easier for the astronauts.
Yeah, just to bend your elbow, or you know, you wouldn't be able to do that if the pressure is up to 14 psi. But at a lower pressure, you can. Yeah. Okay. And they do spend a couple of hours inhaling pure oxygen before they do an EVA. You know, in fact, they used to call it camping out. They spend some time in the Quest lab with lower pressure oxygen. You know, for 24 hours, and then you could actually go back into the regular pressure, and your system is okay for a while, and they would do that, and then their system wouldn't take that long to adapt once they dropped it down to 3.4 psi at pure oxygen, you know. And in reverse, coming out, you know, they got to take their time, otherwise they wind up with the bends as well. You have to watch out for that. You know, it's almost like going into the deep water. Go with me. Back to you, Roy.
Well, that's if you have nitrogen in your air mixture, because the bends is basically dissolved nitrogen escaping into small air bubbles in your bloodstream and producing microclots and all kinds of messy things. So when you're out there in space, you want to kind of breathe 100% O2 to just flush the nitrogen out of your lungs, so that, you know, when you're on a low pressure, pure oxygen atmosphere, the nitrogen that's already was sitting in your lungs doesn't mix with it and confuse the devices that you know keep feeding you the oxygen and such.
Very good, Roy. Yeah, you sound like a book that I've read. You know, I mean, pretty much exactly what I've read in the past. How they prepare for this, and they have an upcoming spacewalk, not NASA, but SpaceX, they plan on doing the first commercial spacewalk probably the end of this year, last I heard. And that's really a weird thing. That what they're going to do is they have four people on board the spacecraft. Two people, one at a time, are going to go outside the spacecraft. But to do that, they don't have an airlock in the Dragon spacecraft. It's like the old days, like Apollo, when they used to do a spacewalk to retrieve film canisters on the outside of the Apollo on back on the moon. They're going to have to evacuate all the air in the spacecraft, and the other participants, the other crew members, are going to have to be in spacesuits, just like the guy that was doing the EVA. It seems like it's unnecessary that they're doing it. I think they're just doing it to say that the first company, private company, to do an EVA. I think they should wait until the Starship is ready to have four people in spacesuits pressurized. Three of them being there while one person does an EA, they come to spend, then the other one does an EVA. And meanwhile, you roll in a dice with the lives of four people. I don't really get that. But we'll talk about that when that comes up. It's a Polaris mission by SpaceX, private company. Back to you, Ron.
Yeah, I agree. These public relations ploys are dangerous because you lose one civilian and the whole game is up. I mean, when those astronauts blew up on ground, that was a real big public relations disaster for NASA. You want to see heroes, they want to see flashy things, but they don't want to see anyone die. And, if these are just unnecessary risks, I feel personally. Yeah, there's a whole big science about how you adjust gas mixes under different environments. I saw a YouTube where they were playing around with breaking the limit of submergible scuba gear. That because you can't just use the regular scuba gear to go 1,000 feet below the surface and such. As you go farther and farther down, you got to be real sophisticated with your gas mixes and such. So it's a fascinating subject in general, and it applies both to underwater and in space.
E2SDP?
Yes, Chris?
Paul just mentioned I never thought about this before, the Apollo. When they opened the doors on the moon, for example, they had to evacuate the air. They had to don their spacesuits first and evacuate the air in the craft, the entire craft, and then open the door, go out, and then come back in, put that air back in, and then take the suits off. I assume this air was pumped into some tanks that were very high pressure because it had to be a lot smaller. It's just astonishing they were able to do all this. It's just so many things could go wrong with this, it's just crazy when you think about it. But am I right? They just pumped it into a high-pressure tank to make it shrink down and save that air and then release it back in. That's all it is.
Let me see if I have it right. And not only that, remember the final mission, they did three EVAs on the moon, three separate ones. So they went through this three different times. They spent almost 4 days on the moon, on Apollo 17. And I think Apollo 16 was two EVAs. So, I think it was from 15, 16, from 15 and up, they had an approved LEM with extra tanks. I think they actually had extra tanks. So, big improvements on the final vehicles, including they were able to get more thrust out of the descent module. was 15, 16, and 17 all had the rovers with them as well. You know, and they're riding around in spaces, pure oxygen, you know. Future rovers, you know, maybe 10 years from now or more, you know, you get into a rover and it's going to be pressurized, and that would be great. You know, instead of, they'll be able to ride around in a shirt sleeve environment on the moon. It's very difficult being on the moon or Mars, and I think even more so on the moon. You have swings in temperature. You have 14, equivalent of 14 Earth days for daytime and 14 Earth days for night. You know, moon is a very difficult place to operate. I guess back to you, Chris.
Yes, all this reminds me why I'm not an astronaut. It's just crazy. But the whole, Jerry Seinfeld had a very funny joke or comment about guys going 250,000 miles up to the moon and bring along a dune buggy so they could drive another half a mile. I thought that was very funny, K2SDP.
Yeah, the last rover that was up there drove for the equivalent of 15 miles. They showed what it would look like if you had the island of Manhattan up where Apollo 17 landed. It would be like the equivalent of driving around the whole island. You know, they did a lot of it.
Just want to add, John KD2BD, who joins us via the chat room, wrote something earlier tonight when we were talking about Dick. He wrote, Dick had 2-meter single sideband schedules while mobile in upstate New York with JK2OVS in southern New Jersey. So add that to our little bit on that. Anyway. This continues to be AC2GS, continues to be the Limar Technical Net. If anyone has any other comments or questions or topics for discussion or want to tell us how field day went for them, then please hit that push to talk.
November 2, Zulu Valley, John.
Yeah, hello, John. How you doing? What do you got for us tonight?
I'm doing excellent, Roy. Good evening to everybody on the net. I was listening to you guys talk about Dick, and I'd never had the privilege to meet the man. I did ask him one or two questions, and really enjoyed the interaction and listened to him various times. But I don't know too much about him himself. What was his profession? What did he do for a living?
Oh, okay, very good, John. There is actually, when Dick passed away, we did a little wake for him on the technical net, and beyond. I think it went until something like 4 o'clock in the morning. So if you're so inclined, you could find that over at amateurradio.tv. It's in part of the archives, and we go over a lot of Dick's history. His son was on there as well, his son. So he was an electrical engineer. I think he graduated Pratt Institute, and most of his career was spent in a aerospace electronics company in Long Island. I'm sure, I don't remember the name, but I'm sure Paul knows it.
AIL, that was Airborne Instrument Laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, Dick being Dick, he never really retired. He did consultation work after he retired, and he, every so often, as a tongue-in-cheek, he would ask Paul to save their questions for the technical net and not ask him technical questions and emails because, that would be his consultation job, and he charges that.
Yeah, like yourself, the man gave freely of a lot of which there. Always did. Always enjoyed it. And, like everybody else, you only wish you took advantage more of it once on, of course. Like when I... All right. Thank you. Just wondering about that. The AC2GBS, November 2, Zulu Valley, back to Met.
Okay. Very good, John. And also, I too never, unfortunately, never could schedule something to meet Dick. We talked on the phone, we talked on the radio, obviously, and we just couldn't find a mutually a time to meet. So, like you, I never actually met Dick in person, but I still hold him as one of my friends. That meant a lot to me when he was alive and talked to me, and we all miss him now that he's passed away.
Well, I was with him a couple of times. Very interesting guy. And he used to show up to the field days and tell great stories. And then one other time he came over to my house as well. But a very interesting character.
Yeah, I've heard the stories. He used to show up in Floyd Bennett Field, Kings County Radio Club Field Day, is still held in Floyd Bennett Field. And one of the members of Kings County Radio Club at the time was Mel, K2K, who was his co-host on many of Limark Technical Net. And so he would kind of make the rounds. He would go to the Limark Field Day. He would go to Kings County Radio Club Field Day. But unfortunately, the same month that I joined Kings County Radio Club, he passed away from pancreatic cancer. So that was the event. So a lot of great people that I wish I had an opportunity to meet and sit down and chat with that I never did. I mean, even many people still only remember John KC2, WGB, I think, from Staten Island. Great guy, wonderful guy. Talked to him many middle of the night on the repeater. Never had the opportunity to actually meet him, unfortunately. So, you know, that's the beauty of this hobby, that you can develop friendship with people you've never met.
So, Charlie?
How about Eric? Did you meet him? He used to come to the field days as well, over at Limark. Another very, very well knowledgeable guy.
Yeah, I met Eric many, many times. It was very strange the first few meetings. He didn't know who I was. And the person who introduced me to him, I guess, I don't know, there was some dynamic going on there, so he basically didn't talk to me. He mumbled something and went away. When I used to kind of show up on the technical net and he knew me, we would have these long conversations at these ham fests of Limark and such. Yeah, he was a very smart guy, funny guy, sarcastic guy. Our giants are kind of gone now. It's a crying shame.
November is over, Charlie.
Yeah, John.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing when I heard you speak about it. You know, I knew you guys had a friendship and, a deep one. And to hear you say you never met him, it's a surprise to me because of, the way you talk to him and intimately refer to conversations you guys had. And being a ham radio operator, I can relate. They had a very, very good relationship with Steve Mendelson, the UML. And the reason for that was at that time I was going to school at night for engineering and driving a tractor trailer. I had a 2-meter rig in the truck, and my hours and his hours coincided, and I spoke to him every single day, going to work and coming home. And that went for over a decade. We set up one meeting, and I had to back out. And like Dick, he was taken too young, and he's taken seat. And I really, I never met him, and I regret I had to back out that day. But you just never know. But I relate to it. I relate to it. I mean, I had a very good relationship with him. We spoke on the phone. And, another guy, another big brain in the room there. So I just wanted to throw that in there.
Yeah, very good, John. Yeah, it's kind of the bittersweet aspect of the hobby, that there are some people that either for temporal reasons or geographical reasons, you never actually get to sit in the same room and chat face-to-face. And yet, you feel that you know them like any other close friend. So it's one of my regrets. We weren't able to kind of come up with anything. It was kind of me. I kept on going to ham Hamfest, you know, Limox Hamfest, and I guess Dick had kind of gotten a little tired. He was more getting rid of his equipment than buying more equipment, so he didn't make it to any of those Hamfests that I went, hoping to meet him and other people that I talked to on the radio, but it wasn't meant to be. So yeah. At least I had the opportunity to talk to him on the radio, which I will always remember those conversations. They were great.
Yeah, what was that website again? You said where you had that for him.
Yeah, it's called amateurradio.tv. It's an archive site. A guy named Mike decided that he was going to record nets all over the metropolitan area. I think he started with about 4 or 5. Now he's down to 1. And I sent him the memorials. I did one for John. I did one for him. I did one for Ann, and they're all posted on that site.
All right, yeah, thank you. Writing it down, so when I do what time, I'm definitely going to look it up.
Okay, very good. It's particularly memorable. His son, Chris, who occasionally would join the technical net, was there that night, and so he gave us some additional insight to Dick when he was off mic, which was fascinating. So it's an interesting listen. It's a long listen. It's a 5 or 6 hour listen, but it was an interesting listen.
Yeah, that alone speaks volumes of the type of man he was. And I just knew him in passing from listening. I knew who he was, who I was. But just that people would see volumes.
Yeah, John K2BD added that Limark has a tribute page. It's limark.org/K2RIW-tribute-page. You can probably Google it. Like I said, go to the archive site, download the recorded audio, and, you know, listen to it as you're in the background. It was a pleasant night. You know, we didn't as much mourn his absence as celebrate his presence and his life, which I thought was the best approach.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Kind of nice when you remember people in that way, you know, emotional garbage, which, unfortunately, family situations, normal, comes with the package and everything. But, those type of remembrances are always the best. They're actually uplifting.
Yeah. Well, interesting that we've kind of used a little bit of his time to remember Dick. We should kind of do that more often because he made this technical net. You know, I come and I do my thing. But I think he was doing it for about 40 years. He was incredibly proud that he had recorded more audio time on the technical net than Johnny Carson had for the Johnny Carson show. He used to mention it regularly towards the end. Yeah. What can you do? Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any technical questions or topics for discussion or comments or want to regale us with stories of Field Day, with the exception of Paul, I don't think anyone has particularly mentioned Field Day tonight. If you're out there and so inclined, hit that push to talk.
WB2BXO, how are you, Roy?
I'm fine, Frank. How are you today? I hope you had a fun Field Day.
Yeah, well, my local club went down. I think next year I'll have to make sure in advance and make definite plans to go someplace for Field Day. The club here used to do some pretty good Field Days, but they kind of stopped doing them for a bunch of different reasons. Anyway, I do remember two things. First of all, Dick used to come over late at night to KCRC field days with Fred Bennett, and he and Mel would hold court from 9 or 10 in the evening till the wee hours of the morning, often until the next week. So I did get to meet him in person, kind of an in-person version of the TechNet. Like, we all kind of gathered around them, and they held court all night, and not a heck of a lot operating went on, but it was still made for very interesting field. How did you guys at KCRC do this year? I know you had some issues with your location. I think you ultimately did get some space to operate and got on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mentioned it at the opening of the net tonight. At first, they kind of said, it's the immigrants are being housed there, so you can't get a permit. Then they said, well, we'll give you a permit for another parking area within Floyd Bennett Field, but we can't give you your old place. And then last week they told us that, if you really want the old place, we'll give you a permit for the old place. So we had it in the same place that we always did. You don't get quite as many people these days because COVID kind of knocked the habit out of people, unfortunately. But everything was put up and transmitted. They made contact with me on the 10-meter net Sunday morning. So I haven't seen all those snapshots of we have a couple of pictures on the club Discord server, but I'm waiting for other people to post some more so I can see what the whole thing ended up looking like. But we pulled it off yet again. I mean, sometimes the Floyd Bennett Field floods out, so we've had one or two where it was just raining too much to be able to maintain a transmission. But we just had some lightning problems last night. But otherwise, things went reasonably well.
Yeah, I think the last KCRC field day I went to probably about 10 years ago got flooded out at 10 o'clock at night. And I remember Howie drove me home soaking wet. And then I started going to the field days down here. Years ago when I was a kid, the old Radio Society of Greater Brooklyn, RSGB, yes, that is an acronym for another organization, although, did field days at, Floyd Bennett. We got flooded out a number of times, but, we had Mitch W1SJ running those. And, when it comes to field day, he stops at nothing. Mere rain, thunder, and lightning would never stop a WB2JSJ field day. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, some people have a great deal of tenacity, and the whole idea is it's sort of set up as an emergency test facility. So, if you set things up that a drop of water coming down from the sky totally ends your field day, then you're sort of doing field day wrong. Back in the old days when you used to regularly do field day at Floyd Bennett Field, they gave you an actual building. They threw us out building, 12 years ago or something. And so, we're pitching tents these days.
Yeah, I think the last field day I was with KCRC at, we were in the tent, so we'd been thrown out of the building already. I do remember those were nice, the field days in the building. That was kind of fun. And when I did field day with the older RSGB as a kid, we were out in tents in the weeds somewhere, out near the airport runways, and how we didn't get thrown out of there in those days, I don't know. I don't think there was, it was still in transition, and there was not much in the way of supervision there. So some of the kids drag race on the runways late at night and stuff like that. It was a little crazy. those were some of the first field days I went to there.
Well, when I got my license, RSGB was long since gone. But I am a member of the other RSGB, the Radio Society of Great Britain. Not because I'm planning to move, but I've mentioned before I really, really, really like magazines. So it's just sort of the way that you subscribe to their magazine, Radcom, which is an excellent amateur radio magazine. I would place it personally above QST unless you're really deeply into the people. They have a lot more really well-written technical articles that are a joy to read.
Yeah, I've heard that. I really haven't looked at the magazine myself, but I think I've heard that. But it's very, very good. I know the AMs seem to get a hard time about putting up antennas until recently. Their power level, their maximum power level was quite a bit below the rest of Europe and stuff like that. But anyway, I have heard that the magazine is very good.
Yeah, I mean, QST has gotten a lot better in the last 10 years. Kind of noticed that people were kind of losing interest and just recontest results. And they've tried to do better. I think they've accomplished it. I have some quibbles with a bunch of things. I miss the gentleman who did the technical articles. Dick used to cite him often, and for a while they were in an email exchange on some subject. But the poor guy, he passed on. They replaced him with some YouTuber called Dave. The column is called Ask Dave, and I try to kind of skip it because reading his stuff gives me a migraine. And they've gotten into the old kind of scam that rather than increase the editorial pages that cost money because you got to ask people write articles, they're reprinting old QSTs and binding them in new copies of QST. But technical articles are considerably better than they were 10 years ago. But there is I think it's a quarterly or bi-monthly, other very skinny magazine that ARRL produces that are incredibly technical. It's too much of a good thing, if you will. You pretty much have to be an electrical engineer and a programmer to know what the hell they're talking about. So I find that Radcom from the Radio Society of Great Britain have a nice kind of medium level of technical expertise where you don't quite need to be an electrical engineer. But, I always temple and ask people and plead with people if there are magazines that you like and you're getting copies from friends who read there and handing them off, consider subscribing, because if subscriptions fall below a certain level, advertising revenue is down, all kinds of things are down, and magazines just go out of business. And once they go out, they don't come back again. So consider subscribing to magazines that you read because of a friend gives you a copy. I like to throw that out every so often. I hope someone actually does it.
Yeah, the problem is print magazines take up space, and most of us live in apartments or small condos, and we don't have unlimited space for all these magazines, especially if you read them cover to cover every month. But, excuse me, I do hear you. Excuse me. You know, it is nice to keep these in business. I think QST, I don't know if there are any other ham magazines in this country still in business. I think CQ is kaput. Is 73 kaput, or are they still publishing? I think they're kaput also. Go ahead.
Yeah, 73 went decades ago. Is it 73 or is it CQ? I always get it mixed up. I think it's it just kind of disappeared the end of last year. I think December was the last time anyone heard from them. The publisher passed away, I think, in March of this year. So that's gone. But 73, long since gone. I think 73 was the magazine written by Wayne Green, who also did Byte magazine, which was one of my favorite computer magazines of the 20th century, which is long since passed. So, yeah, they're all gone. I just QST and the kind of mini magazines that the AI